Hello, Market Watcher. Welcome to the weekend. I'm David Ravel, and this is ValueSign.com for Saturday, November 20. For all of our podcast articles, references, and charts, visit ValueSign.com. Today, our look at the week just passed. Well, it was a big week for the administration in Washington, as they dominated the financial news. On Monday, we discussed the new nominee for the Comptroller of the Currency, Saul Omarova. Currently on the law faculty at Cornell, Omarova has taken some of the most radical positions for a federal regulator that I've ever seen. Among them, the obligatory opposition to oil, gas, and coal, not very good timing at the moment, but perhaps the most relevant to her current nomination, she would like to do away with literally all commercial banks in the nation and have the Federal Reserve take their responsibilities, essentially doing away with the very banks she's supposed to regulate. If she's successful, would we even need a comptroller? On Tuesday, we discussed the massive Biden infrastructure bill, a discussion which continued on Wednesday as we explored the amount of financial leverage that we're currently accumulating in this system. We ended on Friday with a decidedly upbeat note on the new strategy at Ford and General Motors. Perhaps you're like me and not realizing just how important semiconductors are in the building of an automobile. But with the current supply chain woes, neither company has been able to source the semiconductors that they need to keep their plants operating. So the solution? Make their own semiconductors. Brilliant. So much so that I believe this is our way out of this current financial mess we're in. Kudos to Ford and General Motors. So coming up next, our review of the week just passed. Well, Saul Omarova is President Biden's nominee for the next Comptroller of the Currency. Now, the Comptroller of the Currency is the chief regulator for all the nation's banks and thrifts. As such, she would be perhaps the most influential person in determining the future of our banking system. And by my estimation, she's the most radical nominee for this position ever. To fully understand why I say this, let me tell you a story. A story which today will probably feel closer to a fairy tale than to reality. But I assure you that once upon a time, it really did happen. Now, there once lived a man who may have been wealthy, I really don't know, but each month for as long as I knew him, for over a decade, this man would bring a simple slip of paper, maybe something closer to a postage stamp, and each month my office would pay him money for that paper, generally several thousand dollars. Now, this man did not appear to be wealthy. In fact, he appeared to have a very modest lifestyle, living by himself in an upscale apartment. A very nice place, but something that would cost nowhere near the thousands of dollars we paid him each month from those slips of paper that he brought into the office. And let me assure you that all of this activity was strictly legal. There was nothing that either the man did, and certainly nothing that we did, that was not carefully examined by state and federal regulators and demonstrated to be strictly on the up and up. Now, where was this place, you're probably wondering, although the better question is really, when was this place? For you see, the place was America, and it's the when that's important. The when was nearly 50 years ago, here in these United States. You see, it was in my early days as a stockbroker, and that was in the early 1970s. And the man was my client. He invested in bonds, and by all appearances must have had a very large portfolio. But I really never knew how large, because he kept all of the bonds in bearer certificates, actual certificates, and each bond certificate had attached to it several little interest coupons, about a 2-inch by 2-inch little stamp-looking thing, which detailed how much interest he should receive and the payment date for that coupon. He would bring the certificates to us at the broker office, where we would literally clip those coupons for him and pay him what he was due. It was a service that we provided, And not just for him, but as a young broker starting out, I was assigned several of these kinds of clients. Most were older and didn't generate a lot of commission, so the brokerage house was okay with passing them off to a young guy. And this wasn't some new innovation that just thought of in the 70s. This was how the American capital system had operated for over a century. Think of it. My client had complete financial privacy, safe from the workings of unscrupulous frauds that prey on the elderly today, safe from scams and hacks that come for online financial accounts, and safe, dare I say, from a government who sees your savings as their revenue. Now, just a side note. Yes, for U.S. government bills and notes and for all corporate bonds, the registrar and transfer agent had records of my client's positions. But this was before the internet, before prying eyes could see everything he did constantly. I was thinking about this when Soleil Omarova, the new nominee for Comptroller of the Currency, made some of her recent remarks. In addition to wanting to put oil, gas, and coal and all carbon-based energy companies out of business, something that's become almost a mantra since President Obama expressed similar sentiments about a decade ago, but it was her most recent vision for the Federal Reserve which really caught my attention. In Ms. Omarova's world, whose academic training incidentally is in political science and the law, but at least she did do a little work as an undergraduate in economics. After all, her undergraduate thesis was on Karl Marx. Nonetheless, in her vision for the U.S. financial system, she sees the Federal Reserve, in addition to its current responsibilities, morphing into the nation's sole commercial bank, handling all deposits, all checks, and presumably all savings by the American citizens. It would, after all, make distributing those stimulus checks so much easier, don't you know? Now, personally, I was hoping that we would see the end of the stimulus checks after a while, something about a growing economy raising all boats and all of that stuff. But I digress. The principal impact of this new role for the Fed would be complete stem-to-stern monitoring of each and every American's finances. Nothing would be beyond the view of the all-knowing, all-seeing Federal Reserve, which now not only would watch your complete financial life, they'd also control it. Of course, Omarova sees this new all-seeing Fed as nothing more than a convenience. It would make things like paying taxes, fines, and fees to the government so much easier. Oh, joy. All these funds would simply be collected before the citizen would be able to withdraw anything from the bank. You know, withdraw for things like life's essentials, food and shelter. But at least you'll be happy to know that the government would be paid and, of course, able to monitor every last detail of your financial life. Absolutely nothing would escape the overarching view of our friends in Washington. So there you have it. Two very different approaches to finance. One from my little old client clipping coupons from long ago, and the other from the most radical nominee for a major financial position in this government that I believe we've ever had in our history. One of these was American, one is not. Well, it's clear after yesterday that Joseph Robinette Biden would like to be known as the infrastructure president, the person who built out most of the country's most needed work projects and vital links between cities and peoples, the roads, public works, and projects that connect communities. And this isn't an unusual ambition. Franklin Roosevelt had the Works Project Administration and Civilian Conservation Corps, responsible for many of the public buildings and projects that exist today. President Hoover, famous, of course, for the Hoover Dam, President Eisenhower for the interstate highway system. For Biden, this will be a plan that will focus on rebuilding the nation's aging roads, bridges, utilities, and broadband communications. In its initial phase, signed into law yesterday, over $1 trillion will be earmarked for this effort. To give you an idea of just how large this project is, $1 trillion is equivalent to 20% of our workforce, or 8 million workers working for an entire year, dedicating all of their income to nothing but this project. Think of that. 8 million workers working for nothing other than infrastructure. And according to the White House fact sheet, this $1 trillion bill signed yesterday represents only a little over half the total obligation of $2 trillion to be funded by the end of the decade. And of course, none of this factors in the interest that will be needed to allocate for the debt incurred for these projects. Interest alone will likely raise the real cost of the Biden infrastructure plan by 4 or 5 times. Now, it's clear that the president has obligated the country to a massive public works program, by far the largest in the nation's history. Yesterday was, by all measures, an historic beginning on a monumental effort. And that's what makes this all so puzzling. Clearly, Biden is making his mark, building his legacy, and just as clearly, it would follow that this legacy's cornerstone will be infrastructure. Why, then, has he spent the first months of his presidency canceling all the pre-existing infrastructure programs that were just underway as he sat down at the Resolute desk? Remember that first day when he canceled the Keystone Pipeline? A giant public works project that was employing an estimated 50,000 workers and would have brought over 800,000 barrels of oil per day to this country. Oil that would be solely needed this winter as heating costs are skyrocketing. Energy and jobs, something that Biden's infrastructure bill promises to provide, and that the Keystone Project was already well underway to producing. Why did the infrastructure president cancel the Keystone Pipeline? Or take the Southern Border Wall, another major public works project employing thousands. This one seemed to be a no-brainer. The funds, after all, were already allocated. Supplies were already purchased. And in fact, many of those wall components are currently laying out in the open desert right now. The completion of the Southern Border Wall would seem to have fit right in to the Borden portfolio as the infrastructure president. It would have provided a sense of peace and safety, especially right now, as literally thousands of unvetted, unknown invaders march to that border currently, due to arrive any day. Why did our infrastructure president cancel the Southern Border Wall? And finally, why is President Biden threatening to cancel the Enbridge Line No. 5? Enbridge Line 5 is an oil pipeline originating in Canada, which supplies people in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan with 2/3 of their heating needs, and the rest of Michigan with over half of their propane. And yet now, as a very cold, very expensive winter nears, Biden threatens to close the Enbridge No. 5, which has operated for over 65 years without an accident. It's inexplicable. And it gets to the core of this man, who has only been our president now for less than 10 months. Do we really have in this man a leader dedicated to providing the best for our country, building out the public works and projects that will help supply our energy needs, national safety, and jobs as he promised? Or do we have an opportunistic politician bent on making headlines when the chance arises, and then canceling much-needed projects that are no longer politically correct? It's a question that will determine the real legacy of President No. 46. Well, Americans simply love financial leverage. We use it in almost everything we do. When we buy a new home or car, we borrow. When we go to the store, it's easy to use those automatic checkout machines if we pay with the credit card. Most of our businesses and seemingly all of our government uses financial leverage. We love to put ourselves in debt. This week, there have been 3 major events that show just how we use leverage. The first, of course, was the signing into law of the massive infrastructure plan of President Biden. Build Back Better, This plan is so large at $1.2 trillion that it's almost impossible to describe. The financial impact of it won't be fully known until the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, releases their scoring on Friday. But what we do know currently is that every last dime of that $1.2 trillion is borrowed. Not a single penny was raised for this project before it was enacted. There were no funds prepared as a down payment. Nothing. Nada. It is borrowed out of whole cloth. And the CBO has already projected that the interest on our currently existing debt will become the largest single line item in our federal budget within the next 10 years. That's right, interest will be our largest financial obligation, larger than defense, larger than Social Security, larger than everything. Such is the cost of financial leverage. But the federal government is far from the only place that you can find financial leverage. Private corporations have also climbed on the leverage wagon. And the best example of this is the Home Depot. Everyone's favorite building supply and home improvement store, Home Depot is the largest company in this sector, and they've built their company almost exclusively on debt. Now, you may have caught the podcast I did earlier in the year on Home Depot as the most leveraged company in America. Home Depot reported their earnings just yesterday. Now, in their most recently reported balance sheet, they report that the company is worth roughly $74 billion. And guess how much of that is borrowed capital? Perhaps $25 billion or $50 billion? No, much higher than that. Of the $74 billion worth of this company, 73 of that is borrowed. Only $1 billion of Home Depot's worth is in equity. This is leverage to the max. Finally, we come to CalPERS, the giant California-based retirement fund. CalPERS manages the retirement funds for over 1.6 million California workers, the police officers, firemen, and civil employees that work for state and local governments there. CalPERS management is meeting this week to update their investment policy. Now, CalPERS has a problem. Although they currently have on hand a whopping $360 billion in assets, they are really underfunded by about $150 billion. That is, their projected retirement payouts exceed the amount they have on hand. They should be closer to $500 billion in assets currently. So on Tuesday, CalPERS decided that they should enhance the return they are receiving on their investments by adding leverage. So beginning this week, CalPERS will be able to borrow an aggregate 5% of the total value of all their funds, or about $18 billion in borrowing. So there you have it, the three ways we put ourselves in more and more debt. Leaping at the idea to build back better, improve our homes, and plan for our retirement all by simply borrowing. Now, if there's one thing I've learned over the years, it's almost impossible to convince people that financial leverage is dangerous, and all the more so when times are good. When the money's flowing, leverage makes everything even better. It lets you build when you otherwise couldn't afford it, to invest what you don't have money for. But when the cash flow dries up, it can go south in a hurry. We're seeing this currently in China as their entire real estate sector struggles to make interest payments with steadily diminishing cash flow. To imagine that it can't happen here is pure delusion. Well, yesterday we had the latest report on housing starts, that time when construction actually begins, foundations are laid, and a new home starts to come together. Exciting times, and for economists, the unmistakable signs of a positive uptick in housing. Now, yesterday housing starts took another hit. It was the third month in a row for housing starts to come in lower. And when you step back and look at it, starts are now running fully 12% below the level reached just 7 months ago in March. So what accounts for this growing and very negative trend? You see, real estate has been one of the very few, very reliable positives in this shaky economy. Now, Wall Street was quick to attribute the current decline to the rising cost of construction. And without a doubt, that is a very real negative. But I have a couple of friends who are real estate developers, and they're a hardy lot, not easily dissuaded from starting that next new project. Yes, cost is a factor, but there has to be more to this story. And it was pretty easy to put it together. The number one players in this economy and the principal real estate buyers are what economists call the consumer. And you can clearly see that there is a 3-month trend in real negatives for our consumers. Starting in the late summer, around August or so, things started to really turn down for the average American. By that time, the stimulus checks were behind us, the lockdown was over, and life was beginning to return to a semblance, at least, of normal. Now, the first thing to hit our average Americans, our consumers, this year was inflation. And inflation really began back in April, when for the first time, inflation went well above the Fed's target of 2%. That month, it came in at better than 4% inflation. But don't worry, inflation is only temporary, we all thought. Hardly. It turned out that inflation was here to stay, rising every month since then, and literally driving the price of food and gas through the roof. This directly affects all of us by forcing us to pay up for these vital goods and thereby reducing our disposable income, which incidentally is down a whopping 17.5% from its peak last March. And there's nothing that makes you feel more broke than having an empty checkbook at the end of each month. There is, however, another, more pernicious aspect to the skyrocketing inflation, one that economists have a tendency to overlook. Inflation like we're seeing now forces you to spend more. It's not an option to buy gas for those who commute to work, and it's not an option to buy the food you need to eat. Consumers spend more when inflation runs out of control. They have to. It's not their choice. Combine that with the drive to make everyday purchases now before prices go even higher. That's another pernicious aspect of high inflation. And you'll see a rise in consumer spending just like you're seeing right now. But it's not a healthy rise like we normally expect from consumer spending. It's a rise driven by necessity and driven by the expectation of higher inflation-driven prices. So for the average American, the consumers in our economy, two major events are happening simultaneously. Their income is declining, both real income and nominal income last month at least. Stimulus checks are over, and their real income is declining in the face of those higher and possibly rising inflation numbers. But perhaps even more importantly, the average American's view of our economy is changing. Gone is the image of a stable-priced environment when food and energy especially don't change very much. In its place is an economy that suffers from higher and higher prices each and every month. And what's worse, the powers that be in Washington seem helpless to do anything about this situation. All this is reflected in the twin surveys that the University of Michigan took recently. The consumer's view of current conditions and of their expectations for the future. Both surveys are now down 25% from their highs reached just 5 or 6 months ago. We don't like where we are, and we don't like where we're going. And this, it seems to me, is the driving force in the U.S. economy currently. The consumer, the largest player in our economy, representing fully 2/3 of all business activities, the consumer is not a happy camper. They're in a place they don't like, and they fear that things may get even worse. Now, against that background, you want to buy a house? Well, America seems always destined to fight for our independence. There was that little matter with the British a couple of hundred years ago, two world wars and numerous regional conflicts whose aim, at least outwardly, was to keep this country free and independent. Today, the field of conflict has turned to trade. Yet still, there are those who would try once again to subject this country to mere chattel, subject to their dictates. Look offshore of Southern California and you'll quickly see how dependent we are on Asian products. Those ships contain the finished products that our nation no longer makes. Products like semiconductors. Semiconductors, those ubiquitous little gadgets that now help operate nearly every piece of modern equipment, like automobiles. And here's where I have some very good news. A ray of hope at a time that our world really needs some reassurance. Both Ford and General Motors have recently announced that they will begin to produce their own semiconductors. It was, after all, those same semiconductors which had halted Ford and GM production, as dozens of these little pieces of silicon are needed to build each and every car. Without them, their assembly lines simply ground to a halt. Now, I'm sure that both Ford and General Motors feel a little out of their comfort zone. High-tech silicon wafers, after all, are not exactly their area of expertise. And yet, that's just what's needed right now, and in a spirit that we haven't seen in a while in America, that can-do American spirit, both companies are going to forge ahead and produce made-in-America semiconductors. Frankly, I feel better about this, not just because it overcomes today's major logistics problems, but because I'm more confident with the ultimate quality of product that will come out of these American factories. You see, America lost the trade war not because we produced inferior products. Quite the contrary, American products are inevitably of a higher quality than the rest of the world. But they're also usually more expensive. The American production systems generally utilize safe, environmentally clean, and worker-friendly facilities, which are inevitably more expensive to run than our foreign competitors. This is especially true of Chinese production, which is renowned for having the most polluting factories in the world, and many times manned by what we would consider near slave labor. So you see, we lost the trade war with China, not because of inferior quality, but because of predatory pricing. China, with its substandard working conditions and environmental pollution, was able to outbid American manufacturing. They competed on price alone and won. That, combined with multinational firms like Apple and Nike, who were more than willing to take China's cheap prices, drove American production offshore. Now, it's been a long and bitter story here in this country of lost jobs and empty factories. But perhaps Ford and General Motors have shown us the way back, and America can once again gain that can-do spirit. Thank you.